the Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast featuring the Crop Doctors.
Good morning from the Crop Doctors Podcast studio in Stoneville. Tom and I have a phone guest with us this morning, Travis Foskey from the University of Arkansas, Division of Agriculture, and I can't ever do the rest of it. So Travis works in Arkansas. Hey, Travis, what's up, man?
Hey, good morning. Great morning to be with you guys, and I'm excited about our topic this morning.
If you need to say the rest of that big, long name y'all have, feel free.
No, I'm good with what you got. I can't remember it all the time myself.
I bet I got like 45% of it.
I that's good. I think they got the gist of it. I think the biggest thing is that Division of Agriculture component. So we're good.
Well, and our listeners need to know, or at least recall, that Travis is not in Fayetteville. Travis is actually in the Little Rock area, so he's mostly more of a Delta plant pathologist slash nematologist, although I refer to him more for his nematology expertise.
I think he's technically on the prairie, but...
Okay. Okay.
Splitting the hairs.
I'll forgive your lack of
geographical knowledge. Yep. Related to art. Well, you're from Arkansas, and I'm not from these parts. Well, I'll let Jason deal. It's the time of year where his phone's going to explode, so we have people calling my phone because plant pathologists really aren't needed yet, although the jury's probably still out on that based on how many acres we planted last week and how much rain we've received and the temperature that's out there right now. It could get pretty interesting.
Yeah, we definitely missed the temperature forecast this morning because it's chilly.
Yeah,
and it's certainly wet. So, Travis, that leads me to my question that I want to ask you. So it started raining, I don't know, Monday night. Today's Thursday. In the, I don't know, 10 days, say, leading up to Monday night, ballpark the total number of seeds that got planted. And I'll even cut your number down. You can just use Arkansas. Not acres, total number of seeds.
So no, doesn't matter the crop.
Yeah, just ballpark a total.
Okay, so I can just make this up just flying by the seat of my pants.
Yeah, nobody's going to – I mean, there's no right answer. Nobody's going to have the foggiest idea.
Yeah, 10.2 million.
I'll allow it. I have no idea. Okay. Tom, is that in the ballpark?
Yeah, I don't either. I would – if I was an over-under type person, I might say that's probably under.
Yeah.
And that's just – I'm just – that's the first knee-jerk response I had to that because they were flying like crazy over on this side of the river, so I can only imagine that they were doing pretty much the same thing on the west side of the Mississippi River.
Pretty much. Most important for us. I know that there was actually some peanuts that went in and some, you know, of course, rice, but – that wet weather sure stalled everything for most, which is probably a good thing in some cases. It gives people a little time to maybe think about what their approach is for the next couple of weeks.
How much rain did y'all end up getting?
You know, here in the central part of the state, it wasn't that much, a couple of inches, maybe three in some places. It seems like the majority of it was further south, Stuttgart, had more, and then when you got to Monticello, it was much higher.
Yeah, I got six at my house. I've heard eight in places.
I don't have a rain gauge at Hacienda Allen anymore, so.
You have to pick it up in the fall to keep it from freezing and breaking, Tom.
Well, I usually rely on the Delta Ag Expo for that type of effort, and there was no expo this year because of the freeze. So I still have a rain gauge holder and no rain gauge in the rain gauge holder because the last time it rained and froze, it broke the rain gauge.
That's what I just told you. You have to pick it up in the fall and keep it from freezing and busting.
I know. Again, it's my fault. Totally my fault. But, okay. Travis, we have you on this morning because they're definitely, I'll be the first person to admit, I have received, since the fall, more nematode questions than what I normally am accustomed to. And I think a lot of it, I'll tie it back to basically 2022 and 2023 both being pretty hot and dry, and I think we picked up or at least observed more areas in our respective geography that probably have a greater nematode issue than what we've really seen probably the last decade, just based on lack of rainfall.
I would agree with that. I actually had two farmers call me last year and told me I didn't have nematodes in that field. I really, I didn't have any clue. But you're right, that hot, dry weather in the summer, you know, really made them show up on those plants. They really started to cause damage, and those farmers were quite surprised.
Yeah, and I had some of the same conversations, you know, on blacktop roads looking into fields, and then we always kind of came back to what do we do now moving forward from a management perspective. And what I said to him was, you know, I rambled across your field before I got out of here, the blacktop, looked at a few things, was fascinated by what I ran across. I can tell you have a root knot problem. Your best option is going to be choose a resistant variety when those information start coming out. And our listeners should know, because it's something we need you to repeat, because I rely on your data from Arkansas that you do yearly. But why don't you tell everybody, like, how you kind of go about setting those tests up, and then what type of seed that you request from companies that you consider in some of your plot trials on an annual basis?
Okay, perfect. Yeah, so we have a site. First of all, you when you're screening anything, you need a really good site. And typically we talk about nematodes being aggregated, you know, spots in the field, hot spots. This area, this field is actually relatively uniform, so great for screening. So each spring we ask the seed companies, what are you marketing as resistant? What are you selling to the farmer? And we would like to look at it. And honestly, we have some salesmen that come to us and say, hey, Travis, would you check this for us? We bought this seed and we're being told it's resistant. Is it? Can you double check for us? And we place it in the field. And in about August, when the plants are about R4, R5 growth stage, which would be the most severe as far as galling goes, we go out and rate them. So each year we dig up thousands of root systems and evaluate those for galling. And there's a great correlation. More galls, more susceptible, less yield. Fewer galls, more resistant, better yield. And then in the about November, December each year, we analyze that data and get that out to our county agents in each county, put it on our row crops blog, and I try to share it with as many people as possible and tell them. I think either we were having a conversation before, or you mentioned previous, you know, the best is a resistant variety. And those are the best ones to choose from because they've been tested in a comparative system where you're comparing something from one company to another, where unfortunately most companies just rate their own stuff within their own testing system. And they're honestly choosing the best one within their system, but not across companies. And so for the last couple of years, unfortunately, we really haven't moved the needle much. I was looking at data from 2017 and 2018, kind of when we started that test, and about 22% of those varieties I would consider to be moderately resistant. And last year, that was about 25%. So we have some opportunities for improvement.
Well, and I think that's something we definitely talk about a lot in the quote unquote closed door pathology meetings about. That's a continuing issue in the southern United States, is root knot nematode pressure. And a lot of that you can tie back to how many years of cotton we had on some of those particular acres. But I think the most important thing to also point out, and sometimes I think we gloss over this when we're standing in county meetings, is from a root knot perspective, that's a corn, cotton, and soybean issue. So when we talk about rotation strategies or rotating to reduce this being an issue, they are in fact rotating, but they're not rotating to acceptable rotational hosts or strategies, because those are all susceptible hosts of that nematode.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so they're at the very least maintaining those numbers. Something like corn, because of the size of the root system, actually exasperates those numbers. And, you know, I spend a lot of time talking about that because there's still some misconception about corn. But when we're talking about root knot, it is a host. The only non-host we grow in the Mid-South, and it's on a limited number of acres, and I wouldn't recommend it on all the acres where we have a root knot problem, is peanuts. A good cotton variety, though, there is some resistance there. And they can reduce those numbers. I mean, that's one of the goals, try to reduce the number of nematodes based on your soil sample, right? And a good cotton variety that's resistant can reduce them by 90%. The best soybean variety that I can find is only going to reduce them by 50%. So we're still, even with some of our best resistance, we're not eliminating these. And so that's why we use the term management, right? We never say control when we talk about disease. We're just managing them and doing the best we can.
Well, and then in that perspective, all you're doing is maintaining what would be considered a more acceptable yield, and you're managing the pest issue so that you aren't basically losing the shirt off your back. Off the cuff, that's the easiest way to kind of make that statement. And again, that's one of those I don't think we really talk enough about. And I know, you know, sitting here looking at Jason, I mean, Jason's dad, is his farm had been one of the places that Scott Montford had done. I think Scott did his PhD work there, if I'm not mistaken, when he worked with Kirkpatrick. So we know a lot about that part of the world when it comes to both reniform and root knot. And really, in my mind, I wanted to focus a little bit more of this on root knot because I think it is an increasing problem.
Before you do that, so keep that and we'll come right back to it.
Okay.
So you mentioned our three biggest row crops, corn, cotton, and soybeans, being a host for root knot. And we've had Travis on before, and we've talked about nematodes, and then we've talked about nematode sampling. But for people that might not have heard those, step through reniform and root knot, and then the host, which of our crops are most susceptible to those, and then we'll proceed with the conversation. Now, I just felt like that was important to point out to people.
No, and I was going to say, I'm going to volley that to Travis.
Right, yeah, no problem, because it is confusing at times. So for root knot, the crops that would increase or maintain root knot numbers, if we just talk about those three, is all of them, cotton, corn, and soybean. There is some resistance in corn and soybean, but it's still going to maintain those numbers. Again, if we move over to reniform, which is a little different animal altogether, of those three, cotton and soybean are the only hosts. Those are the only ones that it will increase or maintain on. Corn is considered a very poor host or non-host, so the numbers will drop. But because of its biology, those numbers in a reniform field do not drop as quickly as what I was mentioning before with those root knot numbers, with the 90% and the 50%. It's much, much slower.
Is there an environment or soil condition that favors one over the other? A species of nematode over the other?
Right. One of them, so root knot is, I can find it in some of the silt loam soils. But to be a problem on, let's say, soybeans, you need a little bit higher number above the threshold. And the threshold we use is 60 individuals or second stage juveniles per 100 cubic centimeters of soil. So in a silt loam, you may need 120, which is not far-fetched and pretty common in the Mid-South. But it's probably more problematic in general in those coarse textured soils, the loamy sands, the sandy loams. That's for root knot. Move over to reniform. It's not uncommon. I can find it in some extreme soils, which would, for me, extreme would be a clay. And they can still be in those soils. Again, you'd need more numbers in that clay than you would maybe a silt loam. So on the spectrum of soil textures, reniform is going to be on a wider spectrum of those than root knot. Very interesting dynamics. If you have both of those species in a field over time, because of the nematode biology, a reniform is generally going to outcompete root knot. But in both cases, the nematodes follow the host. So if you plant corn, root knot's going to go up, reniform is going to go down. And if you plant any of the others, usually reniform is going to be the one that kind of wins over time.
How problematic do you consider the reniform nematode to be on soybean?
Not as bad as root knot. So on a field-by-field basis, given that root knot is going to be severe, let's say even reniform is severe as far as numbers go, the yield loss by root knot is going to be much higher, 30% field wide, where reniform is going to be much lower in that 5%, maybe less range. But if you switch that and you go into cotton, they're both problematic, and both can be above 50% on a very susceptible variety. So in soybeans, I'm really focusing on root knot as far as yield loss. But you bring up an interesting point. We're talking about rotation. So even though I'm not having a lot of yield loss, maybe with my soybeans, my reniform numbers are going up. They're going up. And if I have cotton in my rotation, now my numbers are higher than in previous years, and you're going to have more yield loss on the cotton.
And in a corn-soybean rotation, if you had both species present, at bare minimum, be holding numbers steady on reniform by rotating the corn, but you could continue to increase those numbers for the soybean crop by using the corn as a rotation if you choose the hybrid incorrectly.
Correct. And so in those cases, you're just kind of sustaining both of them, and it maybe it's the soil type where one actually out-competes over the other. If it's a more of a silt-loam soil, that reniform may have just a leg up over root knot, but you're not going to eliminate both of them.
Which is why I think at the end of the day, regardless of where you are and which state you're in, and really who you are in the plant pathology, nematology world, talking about how important continuing to soil sample. If you have a nematode issue in a field, keeping track of those numbers can be important because it'll definitely help you open some options from a standpoint of rotational strategies. And I think that is a difficult conversation to have.
Is there value in sampling the field for nematodes at this point in the season?
Well, of course, we just talked about how wet it is, and that would not be a good time to go sample. If you have water in the plastic bag after you pull the sample, by the time they get to the nematode lab, they would all be dead.
I was talking more about time of year rather than than right now, the current conditions.
Right. I just had to make that point because we got some samples in the other day and they were just completely saturated.
Wow.
So sorry. But no, so right now, if you took a sample and you had a reniform field, you're still going to get reniform numbers. They may have dropped off slightly from the fall, or they may be pretty close to the same. They're not going to change a whole lot. The root knot numbers are going to drop off by, 80%. Most of them, just the survival of them by the biology, they just don't survive. So it's not going to give you a threshold value like what I mentioned before with a 60 J2, but it can tell you, yes, I have root knot in that field. And I've had that conversation with folks. They're like, I just started leasing this land. What do I do? And my recommendation still would be, go out and pull a couple of samples. And if you have root knot, put in the best root knot resistant variety you have. Well, what happens if I don't have a chance to go and pull a soil sample and I want to plant soybeans? Well, put in the best root knot resistant variety you have. And if you can use a group 5, go with a group 5 and then sample next year and then come up with a better game plan. Call me back and we'll come up with an approach that's going to be best for your system.
Yeah, and I should add, the whole reason this kind of hopped in my head was a couple of weeks ago, some of the conversations I've gotten into is, I pulled a sample in the fall, or I know I have a nematode issue. What are my options if I want to do something like, say, vellum? Can I put vellum out as an in-furrow liquid application with, say, a root knot susceptible variety and still be ahead of the game? Or do I have to go with a resistant variety to manage my root knot population?
I've had some of those conversations too, Tom. Of course, that soil sample is the best predictor of how widespread root knot is in that field. So we're managing, let's say, the entire field, right? Let's say that it's all there. Vellum is a fungicide. It's fluopyrim that has nematicidal activity. It's the same thing as what's Elevo on soybeans. And so it is a good nematicide, but it's not going to take a susceptible variety and make it immune, right? Or make it resistant to root knot. that provides a zone of protection for that seedling to begin. But once those roots get out of that zone of protection and into a higher population of nematodes, they're going to infect it and have an impact on that variety and causing it some yield loss. And we've done trials with in my fields where we've done exactly what you're talking about. And a vellum on a susceptible variety doesn't make a huge impact, a couple, two, three bushels, maybe. And so it's not having a huge impact. The rate range on that is 3 to 5 ounces. And we've done both of those. And 3 and 5 look the same. So if somebody was going to use it, I would just use the 3 ounces on something that at least has some kind of level of resistance, even if it's moderately susceptible. But something's better than absolutely nothing as far as post-plant resistance in a situation like that.
From where I sit, my biggest concern is having the conversation about what you do in 2024 has an immediate impact on you for 2025. So if you choose a susceptible or a root not susceptible variety and say, hypothetically, you put something like vellum out, all you're doing is increasing your numbers for 2025. There's no changing that.
No, that's right. That's what we talk about, a kind of a management approach. And you mentioned before monitoring that. What impact am I having over time? It's hard to get out and sample every year, but if you can get out at least every 3 years, or if you want to be really aggressive and see what kind of impact you're having on your farm every year, at the end of the season, you can see what your numbers are doing, which allows you to come up with a game plan over the winter for the springtime, instead of the situation we were talking about before. Let's just guess, you know, what might we have, and let's just cover all our bases. Well, that can get very expensive. And I know we, you know, if somebody was sampling, sending them to the same lab is another very important consideration. So if you're going to send it to the lab at Mississippi, continue sending it there. If you're using the one in Arkansas, continue to send it there. Although they use the same system and style, some of them use a little bit different counting dish, which the numbers are just slightly shifted to the left or the right of high and low. So just consistently sending it to the same lab will get you comparable results.
Yeah, and tracking it over time is super important to see if you're making an impact on the overall populations that are present, because that's the best way to make an informed decision and a good strategy for managing something like nematodes, because they're not going to go away. I mean, you could tell just as many stories as I could about using something like Telone or a different fumigant, and you fumigate at the beginning of the year, and then you're pulling mid-season samples, and you're still counting nematodes from those samples. So you reduce the population early in the season, and it should impact later in the season, but you didn't take it to complete zero. That doesn't happen.
No, it doesn't. And you think about it, Arkansas specifically in the 80s, we hardly had a root knot problem in soybeans. And now you fast forward 30, 35 years, and it's the most common issue we have in soybeans. And we have not even started talking about lesion nematode, which is out there too. And that's totally another different animal, and that'll have to be for another day. But that just emphasizes the point of monitoring and taking those soil samples, because there's more animals out there in the soil than we can cover in this podcast.
That's right. I mean, there's multiple nematodes that impact both corn, cotton, and soybean. And really, I think the most urgency right now is focusing on reniform root knot from a soybean standpoint, because, we could spend 2 days talking about some of the other issues.
What was that nematode we found in that cornfield way down south, right up on the levee that time?
Those were stubby root nematodes awesome. On corn.
One of my crowning achievements as a field man, figuring that out. I didn't have any idea what it was, but I knew. I knew
it
I didn't need
dramatic.
To be there.
Yeah. Oh. It is dramatic. It's amazing to see stubby root. The plants are just like, they are completely stunned. It's like little dwarf corn plants.
Oh, it was unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, it was like 12-foot tall corn and 12-inch tall corn. On the same row.
If you go further east in some of the area, you know, Georgia and whatnot, when you get into all that sand over there in Florida, they have sting nematode that can be a big headache and issue on some something like corn. And that's, we don't deal with that, or at least we haven't run across it that I'm aware of.
No, that's not a real common one. I think even in our lab, if those numbers come up, it's from an out-of-state sample.
Yeah. Or turf. I mean, turf's a pretty big area. Yeah. Travis, do you think there's any additional follow-up on that? I mean, the one thing that I could say is, where can people access your information related to resistant varieties in the screening program that you've done over the last few years?
Well, I keep all of it on the University of Arkansas webpage under, you know, plant pathology or disease management. It's also on our row crops blog. And any county agent in Arkansas has access to it as well. And they would be a first initial call is to be able to get some of that. And I think even the Mississippi State Soybean Board, as well as the Mid-South Board, I think they post that on their websites as well. And so those would be my first stop. We mentioned vellum. There's a lot of other seed treatments out there. They provide, you know, a little bit of protection at best, but again, they're kind of like vellum. They're not going to really take something that's susceptible and make it resistant or immune, but it is another tool in the toolbox, and it's related to that population density. If we have something very severe, like when a farmer recognizes they have an issue, post-plant resistance. If you monitor things early and the population is low, yeah, some of these seed treatments can be helpful. And they can also be helpful when you have, well, the situation we talked about before, both root knot and reniform. You know, if they can't find, you know, my information on any of those other sources, you and I work together closely, and we can communicate together and make sure whoever needs it gets the information they need. I'm really surprised each year somebody will call and say, I didn't even know you did that. Thanks for this opportunity. I'm glad to be able to share the information that we have it, and it's on our website, so hopefully folks can find it there. If not, they can certainly contact me, and I'll get it to them.
And I'll try to look those links up and add them in the description to the podcast too, Travis, not to give folks a direct link to it. But we certainly appreciate you spending some time with us this morning, and hope everything goes smoothly for you this spring.
Hey, we've already got some seed in the ground. Things are starting off fantastic.
Awesome, man. Good luck.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Travis.
The Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast is a production of Mississippi State University Extension.